From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I am very upset that Chicago State University may have to close their doors and ask for the keys for the employees. That's an outrage. That should never happen. There's really no excuse for it. I believe that the supermajority in the legislature is using Chicago State and many other service providers in Illinois as leverage to try to force a massive tax hike. I believe that's what's going on, and that's wrong.
We have to make a choice. I think we can drive a wedge issue in the Democratic Party on that topic and bring the folks to say, you know what, for our tax dollars, I'd rather help the disadvantaged, the handicapped, the elderly, the children in poverty. I'd rather have my tax dollars going to that than the SEIU or AFSCME, who are out there for their own interests.
As Chicago State University moves closer to closing, Governor Bruce Rauner this week says he's very upset about Illinois not having a budget. But more than 3 years ago, in the second clip, he outlined just this sort of plan as a way to advance his agenda of hobbling public employee unions. Meanwhile, several things happening in and around the U.S. Supreme Court have repercussions back here in Illinois. We'll talk about that and more this week on State Week. I'm Brian Mackey. With me in studio is Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, and in the Illinois Public Radio Statehouse Bureau, Amanda Vinicky, Bureau Chief for IPR and WUIS, and Andrew Maloney, Springfield Bureau Chief for the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
As we go to air on Friday, it's been 275 days since the state of Illinois had a budget. Chicago State, which had previously sent layoff notices to each of its 900 employees, this week they ordered deans to begin collecting keys from faculty and staff in advance of those layoffs, an order from which they later backtracked. But not before Governor Rauner got a round of stories saying how upset he was about that. Amanda, you were with the governor on Wednesday. What did he have to say?
This is similar to what we've heard from the governor on any variety of issues where there is crises due to the lack of state funding. And he says that it's tragic, he's upset, it shouldn't happen. And he put the blame on Democrats in the legislature. They, of course, put the blame right back on the governor and note that he is the one who canceled out any funding for higher education when he vetoed appropriations bills that were passed way back last May by the General Assembly with only support from Democrats. Further, the governor said, you know, we've presented solutions for it, but that Democrats have held even those up. And that is, for example, his calls for changes to procurement procedures to loosen up some of those strict requirements there. He says that could free up money for the monetary award program, these tuition grants for some poor students that are lucky enough to receive them because the money for that runs out. There are more poor kids than there are money to divvy the grants out, even when Illinois is paying for it. And he says, you know, this is Democrats' fault. We've presented solutions. I've given an answer that could quickly give universities their funding. Democrats, and Charlie, I know this is your big point, is that they say, hey, this isn't going to save any of the money right away. He's holding hostage students for measures that he wants. So really, it is yet again, I think, an occasion where you have both sides really digging their feet into the sand, where Rauner, you know, hey, if you really want to help these schools and get them their money, move off your so-called reforms. But Democrats also, there could be a breaking point if it is so important for them to send money to these universities, then move forward and take Rauner seriously on some of his suggestions and ideas.
Well, Charlie, as might be evident from my selection of sound bites at the beginning of the show, the governor doth protest too much, methinks. What do you have to say?
Well, it occurs to me that the bottom line, and any rational person, I would submit, who studies the issue will decide Illinois' problem is that it provides more goods and services to its citizens, goods and services that they tell pollsters over and over they want, than our revenue structure produces dollars to support. And so people who look at this, and it, you know, Republicans and Democrats tend to agree, yeah, we need more money. We need to change our tax structure to bring in more revenue. The problem is that's not going to be politically popular. And everyone is doing this song and dance about, oh, I'm so upset. And it's like, I'm helpless. I can't do anything. I'm only the governor. Or, well, we sent you a budget and you vetoed it. Well, yeah, it was short $4 billion, but I mean, so what? You know, it's this skirting of what the critical issue is. And from my experience as a reporter, and granted, this is dated. This was back in the days when leadership tended to be more, what would you say, from my perspective, more responsible. The governor and they were Republican governors and Democratic legislative leaders, and the Democrats controlled the General Assembly for most of those years, would sit down and say, okay, what do we need to do? Where can we cut? What revenues can we raise? And so we had increases in the income tax rates. We had some changes in sales tax in terms of what was covered and what wasn't. And it was all with the notion that to provide Illinoisans what they desire from the government in terms of education and human services and health care and public safety, we need more dollars. And so we're going to agree this is how we get those dollars. And they would pass the legislation, and people didn't like voting for it, but they did, individual lawmakers. And as a matter of fact, if you go back and look at the history, as I've said on this show before, the people who voted yes for those tax increases survived at the polls at a higher percentage rate than the people who voted no at the next election.
Amanda and Andy, it seems pretty clear that, I mean, as Charlie said, eventually there's going to be cuts. There's going to be a tax hike. The governor himself has said many times that he is open to it. Bernie Schoenberg at the SJR, this State Journal Register here in Springfield this week, had a column Thursday where he pointed out the governor even said he was open to the tax swap idea, which has been something that goes back to Don Clark Netsch's campaign for governor in the 1990s, where you would lower property taxes in exchange for raising income tax rates. In that case, it was to help fund education. So it does seem like that is going to eventually be part of the solution, tax hike, some cuts, and yet they're not even talking about it. They're not even meeting. Amanda, I know you had a story about some of the they can't even agree on whether they are agreeing to meet or not agreeing to meet, right? I mean, it's...
Or who's made a phone call. What right. was interesting, really, was we reporters at an unrelated event with the governor had some time to ask some questions and tried to follow up and actually say, so, you know, Bernie led this off and said, hey, you're the governor. You have a telephone. Can't you pick it up and call the speaker yourself? And the governor really refused to answer that head on. It is not clear to me whether Bruce Rauner picked up a telephone and dialed House Speaker Michael Madigan's digits. Now, of course, the speaker does not have a cell phone, and generally this is coordinated at a higher level. And clearly there are all sorts of ways that you would be able to get a meeting. Neither side is giving details about who called who, when. It seems as if the last time these two men talk, and I could be wrong, but again, it is like pulling teeth to get these sort of answers and details, would have been in December, mid to early December, the last time all four leaders got together. So, yeah, I mean, Brian, it's not just that there aren't all four leaders meeting. The governor has said he doesn't think that that's a good use of his time and that he believes he'll be best served to instead have a one-on-one meeting with Mr. Madigan. And we're really not clear on, again, who called who and why that isn't happening. But that continues to be a source of consternation and frustration and really telling about how far away Illinois is from any sort of resolution, it seems.
And I would just add, too, that I think it's easy, whether if you're at the State House, whether you're a reporter or a lobbyist or an elected official, I think it's easy to get bogged down in sort of the abstractions of all of this and sort of talk about, you know, kind of the theoretical stuff, you know, passing bills and who has what power and all of that stuff. But some of the stories, especially, you know, the ones like Chicago State and like you mentioned, Brian, you know, calling for employees to turn in their keys, I think to the extent that this has been an abstraction for people still, I mean, those are the types of stories and the types of granular details that, you know, really hit home for the folks who are at the statehouse a lot during this budget impasse.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, Andy, because the stories like Chicago State forcing people to turn in the keys. I mean, as I said at the top of the show, we're 275 days into this budget crisis yet. I've in the past referred to it as a stealth shutdown because it's not like in Washington where they put up barricades in front of the monuments and it's very, there's visuals. People can really grasp what a government shutdown means. You can't go to visit your Social Security office when that happens. Services are really limited. The national parks sometimes close their operations. So on the other hand, here in Illinois, we've had state employees continuing to get paid. State police are still patrolling the roads. And the schools opened on time last fall. So a lot of the ways in which a real disruption to state government could be visible to people have not manifested themselves. Now, of course, Charlie, this year the governor has called for Democrats to once again pass a quote-unquote clean school funding bill, as he puts it. It occurs to me that Democrats might counter, they haven't, but they might say, you know what, we just want a clean overall budget bill for the state of Illinois, not just a school funding bill. Do you have any sense? Do you think the Democrats are going to go along with this governor's request on this?
Well, I suspect one of the things they might do is send him, if they send him any budget at all, it will be one bill that has everything in it and let him pick and choose. And it will be on the governor then to make the cuts and justify them. And I assume that he would sign or he would let go through the K-12 portion. The way it works on a budget bill, the governor has 60 days to act on the bill from the time that he gets it from the General Assembly. And on a budget bill, he can cut out individual line items that would be the equivalent of, say, a paragraph in a book. He could eliminate the entire paragraph. Or he can go through and reduce the numbers. So if a number says $10 million, he could cut it to $5 million. But after he does that, after he files the vetoes, anything in the bill that he has not touched becomes law. So what would happen is the Democrats, if they send him an omnibus budget bill, the governor would have to pick and choose and decide which agencies to eliminate entirely funding, which ones to reduce funding, and what to let go. Presumably, he'd let K-12 go through unscathed, and he'd, I don't know, maybe he'd just line item out everything else. So then he would have his clean K-12 bill, but he would be the one who would get the negative publicity for having short-suited all these other agencies.
Of course, that's pretty much exactly what happened this last time around, except it came in the form of six
multiple
or seven,
bills.
Multiple different bills, yeah.
So,
Amanda, as we talk about this, you know, what I've referred to as a stealth shutdown, one of the aspects of that that's been key is that state employees have continued to get paid. Last week, there was an Illinois Supreme Court decision you covered that had to do with some pay raises owed to state employees that they'd negotiated in contracts way back in 2011. The Illinois Supreme Court said in what they were describing as a narrow decision that no, unless there's an appropriation, you can't pay employees those raises. You've been looking into whether that could have any potential effect on the current budget impasse.
All right. So there was a report, for those of you who read Capital Facts, that the Attorney General's office was going to use that decision and, you know, take some other sort of legal action that would lead the state employee getting paid their paycheck, toss out those court cases and lead to something else. She has said in the past, Attorney General Lisa Madigan, you know, many months ago, that at some point the legislature and governor need to come to an agreement. That's the way that it's supposed to work. And I think in that regard, you won't get a lot of dispute. But we are definitely seeing this politicized. And a letter from the governor's office went out to all state workers that said, you might have seen this report. I can't believe that anybody would do that, that I, the governor, believe that if legislators have been off for a month and they're getting paid, that you, the state worker who diligently clocks in every morning also deserves to be paid for your hard work. And of course, there's this sort of strange juxtaposition, because on one hand, you have the governor who, you know, did veto the budget because he's holding out for these changes that he says will help Illinois in the long run. And yet he also has, of course, raised the ire of unions and many state employees, and is moving for an impasse in their negotiations as they seek to get a new contract. And yet, that very same governor saying, hey, I'm your friend. I'm the one that's sticking up for you. Look at this big, bad attorney general. He did not refer to her by name, but that's how it went down in the past. So that has definitely become politicized. But maybe Andy can speak to some of the kind of the legal arguments at play here, because the attorney general's office thus far has had no comment, despite those reports or rumors or whatever you want to call them, has merely said that the office is reviewing the AFSCME back pay decision.
Yeah, I think it's important to recall also the mechanism that sort of caused the state employees to continue getting paid in the absence of a state budget. I'm sure your listeners remember this federal Fair Labor Standards Act required employees to get paid at least sort of a minimum wage, and at least some of them, not all of them. But the courts essentially ruled in preliminary decisions that while we're sort of arguing about this, you know, this constitutional claim that the AG had initially brought up, that there needs to be appropriations, we should continue paying these employees in full, because the comptroller's office hadn't set up their payroll to sort of account for this federal law. So that was sort of the mechanism, and the merits of the AG's argument didn't really get a chance to play out. And I think you saw this decision from the Supreme Court last week, for lack of a better phrase, rehash some of those claims.
And for the
but
record,
then the question is, if the problem back then wasn't that, yes, state employees have a right to be paid regardless, but rather the question that was that on which the decision turned was, well, we can't figure out who is covered by the federal law and who's not regarding minimum wage, and it would be such a hassle, and we couldn't do it in a very timely fashion, so let's just go pay everybody. That was sort of the circuit court decision. One might say, okay, when did that occur? How many months ago? Has the comptroller done anything to kind of upgrade the files? Have the agencies kind of identified who are the workers who are covered by this law? And if not, why not? And that would possibly be a factor were the issue, the ruling of the circuit court, be appealed to the appellate or the Supreme Court.
Yeah, and it is somewhat baffling to me that there has not been more of a constitutional crisis over this. And I think it's probably, as you alluded to earlier, Charlie, it would be very politically unpopular for somebody in the legislature to come out and say, hey, wait a minute, why are all these employees getting paid? Nobody really wants to wear the jacket for this government shutdown that we've had. Our panel on State Week this week is Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Vinicky, Andy Maloney of the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. I'm Brian Mackey. Some interesting action at the United States Supreme Court that echoed back into Illinois this week. Let's start with this Fair Share Union case. This is a case that came out of California. I'm going to throw it to Amanda or Andy downtown, whoever wants to take it. It was a 4-4 tie out of the U.S. Supreme Court on this case. What is that? Why should we care about that here in Illinois?
Well, we should care about that because this is one of the other goals of Governor Rauner. He had issued an executive order, and that's been waylaid some, but and then tried to file his own federal court case that would also do what this California teacher at issue in the U.S. Supreme Court had been seeking, and that would be to free state employees that don't want to be a member of the union, but right now are obligated to pay fees to unions that is for their, you know, benefits that these non-unionized workers still do receive by means of, say, getting health benefits or vacation time, whatever else is part of a collective bargaining agreement that the union had arranged for. And so you have that federal case that the governor tried to be a part of got tossed, but there are several state employees, and he's now supporting their case. So that's going forward. And in fact, Rauner has said that he hopes and believes that it will be next that the U.S. Supreme Court will take it up and then give a definitive answer. And of course, that goes in tandem with all the many questions right now surrounding the vacant seat. The thought had been that, and this is what Rauner said, if Antonin Scalia were still alive and had been part of that decision, it wouldn't have been 4-4. He would have been the tiebreaker, and fair share fees would no longer need to be paid. It wouldn't be the law of the land. And Rauner says, you know, hopefully we'll have a full bench by there. And that may be why he's also made the statements that he is in support of whoever it is that gets the Republican nomination for president. So all of this really is bringing a lot of attention to the U.S. Supreme Court. And as I said, this federal case that has been filed by a trio of Illinois workers is moving forward.
Well, and I think the ruling out of California turned on the question and the lower courts in California upheld the fair share fee, the argument being that the union represents you, and because of a 40-plus-year-old decision called Abood, your dues can't be used for political purposes, but they can be used for organizational activities and representation, for example, as was mentioned, on wages, vacation time, health care, grievance procedures. If you have a grievance, if you're not a union member, whether or not you're a union member, the union will represent you in that grievance. And so the decision back then was, okay, none of your money can be used for political purposes, but it can be used for the day-to-day cost of operating the union. But the argument on the other side, and this was made by the California teachers, I think it was a woman named Friedrichs, argued that, well, some of the stuff that is done organizationally, I don't support. They push for things that I don't want, and it violates my freedom of association, it violates my First Amendment rights, and therefore it can't stand. And that's the position that the governor has adopted. And I guess when the Illinois case moves forward, ultimately it will reach the Supreme Court. Andy, you can correct me on this if I'm wrong, but I believe that the people who are pushing this case before the U.S. Supreme Court, the Friedrichs case, have asked the court to reconsider for a rehearing, haven't they, to try and keep it alive for when there is a ninth justice?
Yeah, I think so. And I think just to add on to that, it's the starkest illustration so far of why the vacancy is such an issue. The 4-4 decision basically has the effect of affirming what the lower court decision was, but it doesn't really have that kind of precedent-setting effect that we're all used to from a U.S. Supreme Court decision. And so that's why President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland has been such a contentious issue, or at least part of the reason.
Yeah, right, Andy, because, I mean, for so long on the United States Supreme Court on so many issues, particularly dealing with labor, but also campaign finance and firearms and all kinds of other things, there has been a 5-4 conservative majority on the court. And now that with the passing of Justice Scalia, it's 4-4, and who gets slotted in there next, be it Judge Merrick Garland, president's nominee, or somebody else, could swing it to be a 5-4 court that is leaning more to the left. And this week, Senator Mark Kirk met with Judge Garland, breaking ranks with his Republican colleagues. Is this a herald of a possible change on what has been the Republicans' refusal to consider the president's nominee?
Perhaps it's not a sea change, I don't think. I believe the leadership, Senator McConnell, has still indicated he's not going to hold hearings on that, and that the next president should be allowed to make the nomination. There are some Republican senators who have said that they'll meet with Merrick Garland in addition to Senator Mark Kirk. I think they include, you know, folks like Rob Portman of Ohio, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, others who
Susan are— Susan Collins of Maine.
Yeah, Susan Collins, Kelly Iote, New Hampshire. There's some other examples out there. But there, some of them at least, like Senator Kirk, are in that position of being sort of vulnerable, being in a state that you know, could go Democrat in the presidential election, or could choose a Democratic candidate to replace him. And obviously, he's running against Tammy Duckworth. So he's trying to stake out sort of a middle ground here. He said, I would consider voting for Merrick Garland after he met with them earlier. And, you know, a lot of people have said that they would, they do want the Senate, at least in one or two polls, to think about this, to think about this confirmation.
Well, even as Kirk is fighting for his political life here and trying to walk this middle road of being a moderate, you're seeing, I think, the difficulty that that presents, particularly for Republicans. It makes conservatives angry, and yet the supporters of Duckworth and kind of more your liberal Democrats are saying, fine, way to go, Kirk, meet with him, but that's not enough. And getting press releases all the time from the Duckworth camp, and there was even a press conference by a group of allies that are now calling themselves Court Matters, of kind of all of these left-leaning organizations that are saying, fine, Kirk, that's just doing your job by having met with Merrick Garland. You don't deserve cookies for that, I believe, is what one commentator had said. What we want you to do is really put the pressure on McConnell. So that's the tact that his opposition is trying to take. And I'm not sure really how much that's going to get attention for this race, you know, either way, really, how much that's at the top of voters' lists.
Well, we're almost out of time. I do want to mention, though, that there was one other thing coming out of the United States Supreme Court for Illinois this week. Case of Blagojevich versus United States. The U.S. Supreme Court decided not to take up that case. Then prosecutors in the Northern District of Illinois announced that they would not retry former Governor Blagojevich on the five counts that the appellate court had tossed out. So he is now set for resentencing on June 30th. The big question, will Judge Zagel of the federal court knock off some time of the 14-year sentence that Governor Blagojevich has been serving in California? Time now for notes from the field. Only about 15 seconds each. Amanda Vinicky.
Well, visitors to the Capitol, if they have any trash, could choose to toss their unwanted items in some very ornate garbage cans that, I don't know, at least are new to me or have stuck out. Everybody's wondering how much they cost. We just don't know. But as somebody had pointed out, the tops of them, which are marble, are finer than most people's kitchen countertops.
Andrew Maloney.
The First District Appellate Court ruled this week that the Illinois Torture Inquiry and Relief Commission, which was created in 2009 to look into cases related to former Chicago police commander John Burge, could not actually take up cases and look into relief for non-Burge-related cases. Senator Kwame Raoul, who was important in that movement to create that commission, has said he's interested in filing legislation to expand the scope, but they're also waiting to see if the Illinois Supreme Court takes up that issue.
Charlie Wheeler has generously yielded his time to me. Just want to point out, Doug Finke had an interesting story in the State Journal Register this week that Illinois has paid about $900 million in interest, just interest, in late payments because of this giant backlog of bills. A lot of that goes to health insurance providers because of state employee health care. So that is money that could have been spent on, oh, I don't know, keeping prisons open, funding our universities. That's our time for this edition of State Week. Thanks to Andrew Maloney of the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. You can get a podcast of this show at WUIS.org. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. For Charlie Wheeler and Amanda Vinicky, I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.